Robert Olin, beginning of Debbie's report on being with Shirley with the cattle and that boy has a book night this on Thursday after supper, the 22nd of February, 73. Channel run over, beginning of the report, Debbie's report on being over with Shirley the Bok Knights this Thursday after supper, the 22nd of February, 73.
I'll bring that thing in here and check it with you. I don't think we have quite enough light, do you? On the visible side.
Oh, I got myself cooked. I don't either. Well, you went on your
rounds
today.
No, not too much. Jane had called me and said her car wasn't working. So I stopped by and looked at her car, and I think she'd have burned up on her a long time ago.
Think what?
Her car should have burned up on her. It was just dumping gas out all over everything. You know, it frightens you to think people drive around like that and don't even know it.
Yeah.
So I worked on a car over the afternoon and tried to get it inspected, but it didn't make it.
Didn't she have a mechanic at all?
Gonna have to put it in the shop now. It'll take some repairs. Oh my.
So you still. You don't know about that university thing.
University thing. Oh, Rick was going to check with Ward.
Oh, yeah, the deal on that is today was the last day of the early registration. But so you don't have to register today. So I just turned the form in so they hold it open, and then they'll give you another registration appointment for the regular registration, whenever that is. It's probably 1st of March or somewhere in there. No, wait a minute. It would be after the 17th of March, I think. And the way that course goes is you can repeat it for credit on a rotating topic. And Ward had said, just change the title and keep going. So he can probably just write something in on that and just take it again.
We just write Brother Williams a letter. Can't go in and get him, and we can't get him on the telephone, so we just write him a letter.
Yeah. Easy says to make appointments with him. That's what I had to do before.
Your typewriter.
Oh, do I?
Well, I guess I better leave off that form tomorrow.
You better what?
Leave off the form. The registration.
Yeah, you just turn that in. And just to let them know that you'll be around.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you somebody who went on the rounds.
Well, I knew something was going to happen this morning because when Shirley called, she didn't Faye talked to her and then had to call me, and I could tell she didn't have the business with me.
Well, she told me that she'd been meaning to call and have me come over because she knew I wanted to see the cows, and she'd just been busy. She said, Mr. Miles likes to come over here and talk to me when he gets depressed, and you know why? Because everything's always such a calamity over here. Last weekend, or what was it, 2 weekends ago, it was that the cow got hung in the fence, I wrecked the car, and Berman got sick all in 3 days. Said he knows there are folks worse off than him when he comes over here. Well, I don't know. Well, we did let the cows into the rye. Oh, Shirley said, I said, you ever planted oats, Shirley? She said, no, I call her Miss Dodd. Yeah, you ever planted oats? And she said, well, I know I always plant rye. She said that it comes up so nice, and well, I could have this whole place in oats, and my cows wouldn't get the filler they get on that rye I plant. I said, oh. Of course, some folks like oats, she said. Oh, I said, looks nice and thick. Oh, yes, she said, it's thick, except in some spots it's a little thin where they've grazed it down, I guess. And I wanted to say, but I didn't, well, there are some people who make their cows eat the high stuff. Oh, and those cows really ran to get in there. We took the truck out and drove through the field and opened one gate, honked the horn, and those cows just started running. Just a stampede to get through the first gate. Well, then the second gate, they wouldn't come up because we didn't go in Shirley's truck. We went in Virgil's truck. They knew it was a different truck, and they wouldn't come through. And we really had a time to get them to come up and go through the gap into the
You mean
truck.
They wouldn't pay attention to the people. It was just
It was the truck. They stopped immediately through the first gate. They stopped and put the heads down and started eating what little grass there was.
Yeah.
So I said to Shirley, oh, they must have seen that nice green grass you got growing here. Nope, she says, they see the truck. They won't come because it's Virgil's truck, and they know it's not my truck. I should have brought my truck, she says. I should have brought my truck. So she honked the horn, yelled at him, come on, baby, come on, baby. The bull was all the way on the other side of the pasture. The bull must have been about 2 miles away, and she's yelling at him, come on, Buck, come on, Buck, come on, Victor, yelling at him. He came. They ran. Oh, they ran. Her cows really run.
Once they heard her voice?
They'd come to her voice. Yeah.
And they ran.
Oh, did they run? They went so fast, they took that corner going into the rye on two legs. Like flying out like that. And the calves would get going so fast, they'd just be scrambling around like that.
Yeah.
When that bull came, I got behind Shirley. I didn't want him anywhere near me. But we didn't do too much with the cows. We stayed up at the house a little bit because Virgil was there, Virgil Bachknight, who fishes. Virgil lives down at the end of the lane with the Dodds. Well, Virgil was there when I got there, and I thought, oh, no, there's somebody else here. It's not going to be very good to talk about cows with Shirley because Virgil's here. And sure enough, Virgil went with us to let the cows in. Not only that, we took Virgil's truck.
Did you hear Shirley talk about Virgil coming to help when nobody else would when the cow was there?
No, I thought Bachknight's was untouchable.
Oh, no, not anymore. I can go into Bachknight's anytime I want. Let me tell you. All I gotta do is say, oh, Virgil, I'd like them shooting lessons. He wants to give me shooting lessons.
Well, how'd the shooting come up?
Well, it came up, the giving shooting lessons came up because Virgil wanted to teach me how to play pool. They have a pool table. The Dodds do. Virgil wanted to teach me how to play pool. He'd been taught by a professional. And I said, well, I've never played pool before. but it might be fun to try sometime. So then we were sitting around after we'd let the cows out, and Virgil went out and got this gun from the Spanish Civil War. I mean, a holster from the Spanish Civil War we'd been talking about Marjorie Rawlings, and he said his family had lived here for 100 years, and they knew Marjorie Rawlings really well. And did I know that they made that movie here? And I said, yeah, I'd heard about that. And he said, oh yeah, and he told me the lakes they made it on and everything. And then he went out to get this gun, and he brought it back in, Shirley said, that I said to Shirley, had you ever shot a pistol? Do you ever use a pistol? They'd been talking about pistols. And she said, I shot a pistol, and I shot some shotguns, but I don't shoot too much anymore. Bourbon makes me a little nervous with his gun. I have this beautiful picture of Furman as being the most addle-headed man that ever walked the face of the earth. Anyway, that's the way his wife interprets him. I walked in. First thing I did, I walked in.
Well, now that wasn't Furman who was under the house.
I'm in there. Wait a minute.
Yeah, you have to
build up to it, because there are these three beautiful pictures of Berman that Shirley told you. Beautiful. And at the end, all you think is that Berman is just loony, that he's got 10 screws loose. I walked in.
Well, that's Miss Mary, isn't it?
That's what Miss Mary thinks. Miss Mary doesn't think he's got anything on going for him. I'm dying to meet Berman. I just got to meet him and see if his screws are really loose. I think this is the funniest thing I've ever. I mean, I walked in.
You read Alan's report on him.
On the tractor.
Yeah, but with Alan's report, he comes out as a stronger person, I think.
The hell he does.
Well, the second one he comes out as a. The first one he comes out strong.
But Alan sees him sort of being strong on the tractor, even though it breaks down all the time.
And yeah, then, he does. That is a violent misreading.
Anyway, the man is absolutely crazy. I walked in and Shirley's painting these little, you know, those wooden clothespins that have two prongs that come down like that, the old-fashioned kind. Well, one of her little boys is going to a Cub Scout banquet this weekend, and they're making little place cards with these pronged clothespins as the little men. Well, to stand the little men up, they had a little piece of plywood, a little wooden stand with another little piece of plywood perpendicular to it so that you could stick the clothespin on that, and the little man would stand up and hold the place card like this. Well, Shirley's painting away bright blue on these little clothespins, and I look over there, and there are about a dozen stands that are bright blue, like the little men she's painting, and then there are another dozen stands over here that are painted, half of them yellow and the other half blue. And these sick colors of yellow and blue. So Shirley said to me, I'm doing this for the boys. They just don't have time to do it, so I told them I'd help them out. I thought Berman should help me. So I said to Berman, all right, Berman, you paint half of these yellow and half of them blue. She said, look what he did. I meant three of them blue and three of them yellow. Little two-tone stand. Says I got to do them all over again. So then, when we were sitting down after we'd taken the cows in, she said she had to get up and make some chili for Johnny that night. She said, we've been trying to have this chili for a week now. She said, I now and then I try to get Berman to get something for me at the store. Well, I told him, pick me up some canned tomatoes. So he came home and he had a little can of tomato paste. I said, Berman, this won't do. You take this back tomorrow and you get me some canned tomatoes. So the second day, he came back with a can of spiced tomatoes. I said to him, Berman, I'm making chili. You know I'm making chili. If I put spiced tomatoes in the chili, it'll be so hot we won't be able to sit down at the table. Take this back and get some canned tomatoes. She said, we still haven't had our chili yet. So... Then we got to the guns. She said, Shirley said, Berman makes me a little nervous. He's so careless with those guns. And then Virgil jumps on this, and he looks at me, and he says, what do you think would happen if you took a 22 and put a 22 Magnum bullet, a shot into it? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know anything about guns and ammunition, but I imagine the gun would explode. And he said, well, and he looks at Shirley, and Shirley says, hit you right here. She said, that was this was 16 years ago when Johnny was a baby. Johnny was 2 weeks old, she said. Johnny was 2 weeks old, and I put him down for a nap, and I was lying down taking a nap, and I'd heard on the radio that morning, that there were escaped convicts out, and I was a little bit nervous because one of them was mean and dangerous, and I was a little bit nervous. And she said, and it was fall, and the leaves were down, and they rustled under the house. So I was lying down, and I heard something rustle, rustle, rustle under the house. So I got up.
I hope it wasn't Berman.
I got up, I grabbed the 22, and I went outside, and I squatted down, and I held the gun, and I said,
the rifle?
Come out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come out of there. I don't know whether it was a rifle or a shotgun. They just said 22. She said, come out of there. Nothing happened. And I just heard this rustle, rustle, rustle. So I yelled, come out of there again. And all of a sudden, this little armadillo comes tearing out of under the house, and I wham, bam, hit him. And she said, the gun flew up and hit me right in the forehead, knocked me out cold. And as I went flying down, the gun went flying up, I saw the armadillo going up in the air. She said, I don't know how long I was out, but I think it was all afternoon. And when I came to, I looked up, and all I could see was the pine trees, and I could hear the birds singing. She said, you know, I thought to myself, if this is heaven, it sure looks a lot like home. So she gets up. She gets up and crawls into the house, and Berman comes home 15 minutes later. She says to him, Berman, what in hell did you put in that gun? He says, oh, I had some 22 Magnum shot in it. She said, and then he looks at her, and he says, you know, you could have been killed. You're mighty lucky. She says, I know I could have been killed. Why'd you leave the shot in there? He said, well, I meant to take it out.
What did he have the shot in there for?
She and Virgil tried to figure out why he put the shot in there. They apparently discussed it at great length at the time.
Yeah.
And Shirley could not remember why he'd done it. And I suggested maybe he just wanted to see if it fit.
Yeah.
And Virgil said no, it couldn't have been that he just wanted to see if it fit or not.
Well, Virgil would be knowledgeable.
Oh, Virgil is a crack shot.
Well, you may lose out if you...
Oh, he just says he'll give me shooting lessons, and all I could think of to say was, well, I don't have a gun, Virgil.
We've been trying to meet Virgil ever since we've been over here.
Not really,
Faye. The whole Bach Knight tribe. Well, just give me a tape recorder and send me over there. You may never see me again, but it's Shanghai to Georgia.
John Henry is the only one that I'm interested in.
He's the one that doesn't wear a shirt.
That's right. Or shoes.
Or shoes. And no teeth. Yeah.
And he walked in and bought the Buick.
No. That's George.
Oh. Well, there are two of them that don't have shirts and shoes.
I don't know George. I've never seen him.
Oh.
But John Henry is the one who is urbane.
Was it John Henry that we talked to? Oh.
Yeah. He's polished. He is. You see, he has those old world beautiful manners. Just like Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
Except he does it with a flourish. I only seen him once, close up.
We saw him once, yeah.
Just once.
But Virgil went to the service.
Virgil was in the service, and then he got out, and Shirley said, oh, he makes good money fishing. He makes good money. He knows all the lakes around here like the palm of his hand. He makes really good money. I just wish he'd get something to occupy his time. Because he comes up to their house and plays with her boys. He plays pool with her boys all the time. That's what he does. And the reason he was up there this morning was he took his sister to the bus, and Shirley took her boys to the bus, and this one boy, Timmy, wasn't going to go to school today for some reason. He didn't want to do what they were going to do at school today. And so Virgil saw that Timmy wasn't in the car, and he said, "Where's Timmy?" And Shirley said, "Oh, he's staying home today." And Virgil said, "Oh, he's sick?" Shirley said, "No, he's not sick. He just doesn't want to do what his class is doing. They're going on a field trip today, and he doesn't want to go." "Oh," says Virgil, "I'll be up and shoot a little pool with him." Shirley says to me, "He's been here the whole blessed morning." This was at 9:30.
Oh, my.
He's the one, though.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You were over there a good while.
All morning, yeah. Well, and then on the way back, I decided I'd just stop off and say hi to Miss Mary, just because I was going by her house. And so I walked in, and Marvin was outside. And I said, "I'd just been over at the Dodds putting the cows on the rye with Miss Dodd, and I just thought I'd stop and say hi." He said, "That took you all morning?" Yeah. Polite Marvin is. "That took you all morning?" I said, "Oh, well, I stayed and talked a little while." Then I went inside, and Miss Mary was just in fine form. She has a nadding machine.
A nadding machine?
Yeah. Marvin gave her a nadding machine, and she's trying to learn how to use it now. I told her when she learned how, I sure wanted her to show me how, because I've never been able to use one. She says, "Oh, she does all right, except she just forgets to clear it."
Yeah.
And so far, all she can do is add. She said she hadn't learned how to subtract yet. But, she really likes it. It's out in the front room, sitting up there.
Well, this is a big old crank handle.
And it's a little one.
Oh, look.
It's only about this big, brand new.
Yeah.
Little.
She'll
to help
it.
Her out with the books.
She'll use it about twice a year. I wondered who kept the counts over there.
Oh, Miss Mary told me that she does all the business. She did all the business for Mr. Guthrie, and she does all the business for Marvin.
Yeah.
Pays the taxes, takes care of the deeds, does all that.
Yeah.
Said if it wasn't for her, they just wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And she was in good shape this morning.
Oh, she was laughing. Oh, was she laughing. She was just carrying on. That's just something fierce. I walked in, and I told her about, I just said I'd put the cows on the rye, and that they wouldn't come for the truck, because it was Virgil's truck. She says, "Oh, Virgil Wagner was there." I said, "Yeah." She says, "Oh, he's going to be setting his cab for you." I said, "Miss Mary, what are you saying? How do you know that?" "Oh," she said, "a little bird told me." Then she said, "It's a good thing for you those cows wouldn't come for that truck." I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, now Shirley and Virgil won't have any reason to get you over there." I think that's right.
We figured that's what she and Marvin talked about tonight. Virgil was setting his cows for them. Virgil came home from the war and went to bed. Slept all his
didn't get up for 5 years.
But you didn't have to explain all that to her. She little bird told her.
Little bird told her. I didn't have to say anything.
But you saw her in good form.
Oh, she was just laughing. She'd throw her head back and open her mouth and just laugh and laugh, and her cheeks would go. I forgot now what we were laughing about so much. Nothing much. I told her it had rained as much as she said down south, and she threw her head back and said, "I told you so." She was in fine form. She wanted to know when Shirley was coming over. She said, "Dave, where is she? She was supposed to come over this morning." I left her with Virgil.
You know, I looked over this this grant thing.
You were hearing Mr. Mayor talking about it. He said, you're going to see these people. And he didn't get up. He'd get up and eat and he'd go back to bed. And this is why I was so surprised.
And I don't know how they would find out what the hell it's all about from this. I don't see anywhere where it's all about. All I see are those little narratives, those little things about Miss Liza and and then the recast that. That's as close as I get to it. And the rest of it is dispersed. A little here, a little there. I don't know. Now that foxfire thing, you see, that doesn't really say what it is. See, foxfire is a remarkable adventure. At first sight, I thought it was very simple. A few old timers talk about processes, making soap, putting up meat. Then I realized there were so many processes, and certainly not the usual handicrafts of weaving and making rag rug. And I could see it was all done with such taste. What surprised me more, the old timers were allowed to talk. Mr. Andy Webb tells how he called up a turkey gobbler for his father back when flocks of turkeys were in the woods. Now, as the editor says in the introduction, it was his first year teaching, and his 9th and 10th grade English and geography classes were bored to the point of misbehaving. So one day he came to class and proposed that they simply discard the text and do something more to the point. Get out a magazine. Now the young editor has a longer background in this community and this way of life than apparently appears. It's a small public school in a mountain community. And I gather it was a kind of center for mountain crafts, and the fine old missionary spirit seems to survive. And it is quickly apparent that the young people let loose on their community can perform. They can go from the world of their peers to that of adults. And for the first time, they listen to parents and relatives and the people of the community. And they are fortunate. They start right. They listen to old-timers explain the process. One girl's grandmother is going to make soap for the Harvest Festival. She takes some of her classmates with her to watch the process. And they are surprised that Mrs. Pearl Martin loves an audience. Would she wash herself in that lye soap? And when would she put in the perfume? I thought she'd never stop laughing, her granddaughter said. Like so much of the 19th century, these processes are visible. It wouldn't be so easy to visit the livestock market and see what goes on, and harder still to attend a meeting of the town council. Now, they are conscious of being in a culturally distinctive area that is cut off from the main thrust of our country. That is, they're backward. Not all the roads are widened and paved. The suggestion is that there's still other such areas where 10th graders can report on a former way of life. Now, my experience, as different as it is, enables me to appreciate the foxfire work. It in turn makes these points clearer about what I've done. Now, we all share one risk. Mr. Andy Webb tells how he called up a gobbler for his father back when the flocks were common. He uses the language he was born to, and it goes against him. And so does a photograph of him in overall standing in a cabin door. He run down, he'd gone to sea. Not necessarily to me, but to city people, as we used to call them, and these are those who are so well off and have so much. It is more than a risk. Condescension is certain. Part of any proposal has to be to guard against that attitude. Now, the old way of life, in Mr. Andy Webb's case, rests on calling up a turkey. The way it works out is that calling up a turkey is more interesting than Mr. Webb. I'd like to pick up where folk Foxfire leaves off, give Mr. Webb the floor, and let him talk. It was like an illumination when I began to see that people of the countryside, to use my term, can report on their experience and reconstruct their lives right before your eyes. The staff of Foxfire are not quite mature enough to do this, I would think. The two sustained examples of talk are promising. The book opens with Aunt Harry, pictured as the last of the clan, and there was no one left in her house. During a freeze, her cellar door stuck, and she couldn't get to her food. She had so little strength. The staff picture her at this last desperate point. When in her talk, she could reconstruct vigorous times, and I would prefer the vigor. At the end is Mr. Willard Green with a wicked smile. He has that big dishpan before him, and he's peeling tomatoes he has just gathered and scalded to can. And he talks. It is odds and ends of the old life, and then odds and ends of the present he does not know firsthand. People don't live right. Parents don't control kids. The politicians raise their own wages. The day of the Lord is in sight. The astronauts didn't set foot on the moon. All of this is outside of the experience. And what I find is, a man like Mr. Green can talk only as well as I can listen. And the staff, Foxfire gives most of the attention to the old-timers, the young people who work with me. I learn as much from them as I do from the countryside. At first, it is what opens up their own experience to them. All their habits and conditioning, they have to go against them even to look at their experience. And in time, they can project and listen to the experience of those they talk to. But they have to be scholarly now. Mr. Willard Green just came by the gift. It was in his culture. And I do not work with old people in a backward area. So far, I find no specific area or age. Just the capacity for experience and the faculties for reporting on it. But you see, it still, he doesn't sound like a request for grant.
I think it'd be a lot stronger if you said not I propose to, but say I have done, because you have.
Yeah.
You know. Say you've gone way on. It's there.
Yeah, but I don't say that when I
when it goes on. It's like. Of course, you don't want to run down Foxfire, but what you've got is more meat in it than what they've got. Because the people they've got, you could take the people out. At least that's what my impression is. And the processes would still make their whole thing hang together. But more emphasis than those actual living human beings. And point out that it is that you don't want them weak. I mean, if you want to look at crummy people in hard times, there's no trouble. It's all there. The welfare records will have everything you want. But you want to see, somehow you have to emphasize that, to see a person for what they are. Oh, maybe times have forced them to change, but there's still that, very vital person in them, and it shows up in the talk.
Well, I see. I started in, and there I thought, well, I'll just get a fresh start, and I'll make it clear. And I got right back into the narrative again. And I thought of Miss Liza, and then before Miss Liza, you see, I worked for a long, long time with Miss Anna Woods. She's the one. She was really the light, and she was in the 90s. And And when she was sitting in one of the middle rooms on the way back to the dining room kitchen, she was over in the corner behind the stove with that little light blanket over her knees, and I'd sit there and we'd talk, she'd talk. And I left that, I had that little off-color German tape recorder. I left it over there, and took down those things. I've got them now. And the first one I did, it was a very poor tape, but it was right clever. I called it Miss Anna in her corner. I was just looking for it. The transition, she was in her corner. And you see, she couldn't get up and go anywhere. And she told me what they're all doing. Freddie was out in his melons. And little Jane had gone to the revival the night before, but she didn't come in and tell her what the preacher said. She said she never did that. And then something, I forget it now, something takes her down to McIntosh, to a part of the family. And that fine woman down there, who was a model housewife and member of the community, and she married this doctor, who was Ife, with one who'd lost one arm.
Yeah, I can't remember that.
Down there. And she was circumstantial about that. And then when I was working on it, I got Annette Hayden. She was the most cultivated person I ran into down there to line out all those people. And so I put that into Miss Anna's tape. She died in 1923. And Miss Anna learned so much from her. And what it was is very simple. Is, you see, her mind is very clear on what goes on now and what went on then. And the children, you see, will look at her and think she don't know anything. But they are the ones, you see, who don't have access to her. So it was rather a neat little thing. Well, I typed it out and took the tape over there and the typescript and left it with them, and I didn't hear from it for the longest time. And I didn't say anything. And what I finally, and then one time I made the occasion to take it over to her son, Rob, and I just played it for him. It wasn't long, you see. And read what I had written about it. It wasn't very big. And you know what his comment was? He said, "Now you got one of those dates off." It was 1924. And when Jane, Fred's wife, runs the store, when she, first, the only thing she said about it was, is that, she says, you know, this fella, Miss Anna, little Anna's husband, in the legislature, who, when they speak for special interests,
Lobbyist?
He's a lobbyist. And Miss Anna, in that tape, had said, what do you think about lobbyists? I know what she's talking about. And Jane said, he don't know. And he won't like it. That's the two comments I got. And you don't have to hit me on the head. I could see, and I never tried again. You see that they can't listen, they can't read, they can't listen. You give them all the tapes, they never play them. They just lie in the drawer and go to pieces. Don't even talk about Miss Anna. She was a remarkable person. Well, anyhow, that was. Now, I was trying to get the chronology. I talked to Miss Liza on her porch in that little obituary tape, I called it. And that was in June of 67. And she lived a year. And I don't remember. and 67 was also the year Bill Wynn had watermelons in the back pasture. And that was the finest thing that ever happened to me. See, he was a pretty nice fella. And he was just an orphan, poor boy, and he married this girl. And her father was pretty well to do. He ran that building supply place down there, the McIntosh Hardware Store. And boy, it went on back to the turn of the century. And Bill Christian. And he underwrote all the farmers. He didn't beat them, he just underwrote it and sold them the stuff. But he wasn't a produce man. The produce men were the ones who beat them. He just let them have money and fertilizer. But he didn't charge him anything in particular. I mean, he didn't beat him, but he did make money. And then sometimes he'd do it on shares, you see. Make a little extra. Well, anyhow, he went from here down to Ocala and got into banking business, and he's a millionaire. Bill Christian.
This started in about 66 with Miss Anna.
And so Bill Wynn just took this store over, you see, and ran it. And he had these two good men down there, Rob Wood and Henry Burry. And both of them retired now. But I got in on the last few years of their active life. And they were marvelous. They knew everything, and they'd tell you, you see. And I was special with both of them, you see. Rob Wood, he's gone out there in one of those sheds to look for something. something and stay out there half an hour and talk to me and tell me how to do things. And Henry does the same thing. And Bill Wynn was like that. Well, Bill had these melons back here, and he made a lot of money on them, but he didn't need the money. And he hired all these nigger boys, and that's one reason he put the melons in, partly because he'd like to get out of the store, and partly because he'd like to provide a little employment for a lot of those fellas down there. And I remember they had to have them on hand to, they loaded the trucks, of course, and then they took the trucks from the field out to the road, and then the big trucks would come that were going to carry them to Atlanta, you see, and they had to be there to load the big trucks. And sometimes they'd lie around a day, half a day out there on a load of melon. And Bill Wynn didn't get it. He rode right by there and hollered at them, you see. And I'd go back there the first of the season when the watermelons were just coming in. The coons got into them. And they'd go out there more and they'd find 10 or 15 that the coons had got into. Well, as it turned out, what was 10 or 15 melons in 15 acres? But the biggest time we had was finding out how to deal with those coons. One thing was to get a dog out there. And some said, if you just get some dogs out there, whether they run the coons or not, the coons will come out there and smell that little dog track and they won't go in. And what we did was we wound up poisoning them. And what do you do? They put the arsenic in an egg, a hen egg. And I stood out there and helped Rob doctor them up, you see. And then he put them around here, there, and yonder. But he had to keep track of them, you see, and know where they were. Well, something would get them, but he never got but one dead coon. Probably others around there. But anyhow, it was a tricky business, putting out arsenic, you see, for the coons. But a lot of things like eggs. And Rob did that. That was his idea. But what I did, I remember, I went to the countryside seeming, it seemed like it was still holding together then. All the old countryside was still there. And Miss Anna was there. She was still living. And all these other people, and Mr. Boyd over there. And I'd tell Mr. Boyd what the talk was, you know, and he'd give that little laugh, that's all they know. And then he started talking about how to get rid of coons, you see, melons or anything else. And he had done it. Well, they all had. This old Mickens, what was his name, you see, he was a foreman out there. Mm-hmm. And he'd done that all his life, you see. They had matched wits with the coons. And there was one of those boys in particular. I had an old 56 Chevy out there that the transmission wasn't working. And he got I caught his eye. And he just couldn't keep from coming up and looking at it. And he talked, big, tall fella. He couldn't do anything much. Except he could work in melons. And he married some little girl that was a witch, and they lived down in Boardman, and he couldn't even get to work. He wasn't resourceful enough, he could even get to work. He didn't even have enough influence that one of his neighbors would pick him up and take him up the road if he was going that way. But he was a fine fella. Had that lyric gift, or he could, I taped some of the things, and you can hear that. And it just sounds as if it's, now he's not so, it sounds like Frankie Chitty, he's not that good, but he has that marvelous lyric gift in his talk. And he could just talk from now on. I can't say it just exactly how it is, but it's long. And I finally fixed up that old thing and let him have it. A little of nothing. And all held together. The whole, all of it was holding together at that time, and that was the summer of 67. And all I had was just a little video tape recorder. No, I had a big one too, but it wasn't any good, and the little one wasn't any good either. I got it from the couch down here. Yeah, Couch called. He made them. But he didn't know a thing about them. He couldn't use them, and he couldn't repair them. And that was how I lived through that. I don't know. They wouldn't work half the time, you see, when I was taping. And
I can almost remember this business of trying to get the tapes to work and over a period of years was just almost a nightmare.
Yeah.
It just didn't, you all haven't any conception.
No conception.
As to how, that, you see, we're not even conscious that the thing won't work.
No.
But just time after time after time. You know, he'd have somebody in here talking, just be with him.
See, I had the idea of getting it spontaneous. Well, I thought I had to take the machine out where they were. Well, it took me a long time to learn I couldn't do it. And I'm still tempted, you see. Well, hell, at one time, we set up a transmitter. I just put a little transmitter in my pocket, and we got a receiving station there in the car, and it worked.
You got him and Barry in the store.
Yeah, the only thing, it took two people to operate it, and it wasn't two of me. And Faye is not a person when it comes to that. She was an operator.
Some of the ways that this had to sort of has come about might be, you know, just a brief little sketch. As you were talking, and I was thinking, but you need very little narrative, as Rick says, but just a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, all this narrative just throws people off.
Mm-hmm.
It just throws them off.
You don't have to say that six more times.
But,
I've already told you that.
But I was thinking about the process. I mean, the thing about it, that is something. How far you've come. And just that part.
Everything went against me, all my instincts, just like you find. You see, the thing that, you see, nobody I worked with on the sound knew the sound of the human voice. All they have is that jukebox, and what they call those systems.
Mm-hmm.
And all those things do, you see, is make the house vibrate. And there's no sound to it. It's just like a jet airplane. It just destroys the ear. And that's all they work with. They have no. I take it down there and ask Dick Morris. And he said he couldn't tell. He said he had all this, he listened to all this sound. He couldn't hardly hear what I was saying, what I had. through all that. But in 67, it still held together. Mr. Boyd was over there. All those watermelon people, Bill Wynn, and old Henry Berry back then, and Rob Wood going back there six times a day. And old Cecil Pardee broke it and put the fertilizer out. I'm telling you, that was a vigorous world. That's the most vigorous world I've ever been in, close in.
Just traffic up and down here all the time. All day long. Just real interesting people in and out.
And the watermelon season lasts a long time.
You'd be surprised how long it lasts. Truckloads.
You see, they plant them early.
They're planting the dads right now.
Yeah. They start breaking it around Christmas or a little after, you see. And the season lasts through the 4th of July.
Well, the difference in this, as we see it, as I see it, this planting of Bill Wynn, he's wealthy to start with, and he really wasn't just to make money. It was kind of a community project. And he had old Will Mickens' son, Mickens and Rollins, out there. And they were so proud of it.
Yeah.
They were so proud of that patch back there. It was the best one in the whole country.
Yeah.
And Bill wanted to bring his friends out.
Yeah, that's it. All come out. Man, around the drugstore down
yeah.
there. Wilson.
Yeah.
All
the other ones.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just somebody putting in a watermelon patch and going to harvest it and bringing in people to pick the melon. It just wasn't that. It was.
You see, Bill Wynn was rich, really, and he didn't want to haul the melons through here. It was hard to do them. So he could haul them through anybody's property. He spoke to the company over there, the Richardson brothers, and they let him go through that lane and right through that orange grove. So they just took my fence down over there and you know, where they could go in and out. And it's nice to be like Bill Wynn, to be associated with him. If I could be associated with somebody like that, see, I wouldn't. You see, he could float me and his father-in-law, Bill Christian, you see. He wouldn't do it. I was down the only time I ever saw Mr. Christian to know him. He was down there in the store and in his shirt sleeves, and he had a broom in his hand. And he said to Henry Berry, he says, "You know, I almost got out without noticing this." Why, he says, "This broom handle is crooked." He took it back over there and got him a broom with a straight handle. I went over there and looked at it with a crooked handle. I said, "Miss, Henry, I just like a crooked broom handle." So I brought it on up here. See, he got $1 million.
It's those pictures up there, the watermelon.
That's the only time I ever saw him.
That was watermelon.
I could see him, you see, but I don't associate. I don't go to the civic clubs and things like that. And I won't, I never will do it. But I need to be associated with someone who does.
Yeah.
He can't do everything. But I don't think any of this stuff's worth hill beans. I don't know why I can't just put it down straight.
I just don't believe the person who's in it can do it. I think he can. Debbie and Rick could do it better.
Well, they have a pair of the free to set it down.
They know as much as I do. Yeah, and even maybe somebody who's not as close to it as they are. But you have to know. you have to know what was going on, but it's almost as if someone who were completely removed would be able to set it down in the kind of language that you want to put in a grant proposal. I mean,
yeah.
We laugh about Shaw Grigsby, but maybe he could put it in the kind of language that would get a grant.
Yeah.
Well, this is what Lester was saying, you see, Chris Lester. This is what I was saying to Don.
Yes. Well, you have an example of it, you see, in that Paul Cunningham on the Today program, the American Museum.
Yeah, make it crystal clear. But a skeleton of that, something ought to be. Like Rick said, you can just make a statement that this is what you've done.
Mm-hmm. Because there's so much strength in that. That it isn't just an idea.
Glad you got that gasoline out of the
car. Yeah.